Amory Rivera's Alien Abduction. Extraterrestrial Encounter of the Humankind. By Amory Rivera. 2011. Foreword. A treasure is revealed in the pages you are about to read. The nature and implications of the events narrated in this book could contribute or even lead the way into a course of action that may very well determine the future of this Earth's humanity. Mr. Amory Rivera's story not only answers the age-old question of are we alone, but it also reveals an almost unimaginable realm of possibilities that are most definitely within our reach and that can bring about a monumental shift in our reality. Mr. Rivera is one of the most decent, humble, honest, sincere and caring people I've ever met. This honesty and sincerity is what permeates the words that make up the complete narrative of his experience. Those same characteristics are also what make this story so compelling. As you will come to sense in your journey through this book, Mr. Rivera is a very practical and reasonable man. The very simplicity of the way of telling the story, in which he practically holds nothing back and leaves himself totally exposed, is evidence that one of the reasons this person chose to write it was because it really happened. In this book, you will go through a myriad of emotions. Sometimes all at once. The story is at times chilling and scary, but also funny, heartwarming, and uplifting. It will also, if your mind is up to it, present you with statements that will most likely call forth an expansion of consciousness, which, again, if permitted, will provide a range of possibilities that'll widen your current state of literal and metaphorical vision. A range of possibilities that can certainly shape up to become a very important piece of the puzzle of the reasons and responsibilities of our existence. Make no mistake though. With Mr. Rivera's approachable, sensible, and honest tone, comes also an inevitable rawness that will put you face to face with a reality we cannot ignore, and that is a matter of great concern. The knowledge of life and beauty beyond our imagination, and sometimes stubborn denial, can undoubtedly fill our hearts with joy and hope for a brighter future. However, it also requires a total acceptance of immediate responsibility and duty, as well as coming to terms with our universally childish behavior and sometimes even disregard for the wonderful gifts bestowed upon us and entrusted to us. Our intelligence and our technology have given us the power to affect the climate. How will we use this power? Are we willing to tolerate ignorance and complacency in matters that affect the entire human family? Do we value short-term advantages above the welfare of the Earth? Or will we think on longer time scales, with concern for our children and our grandchildren, to understand and protect the complex life support systems of our planet? The Earth is a tiny and fragile world. It needs to be cherished. Carl Sagan. We may consider that we've come a long way since the days of our distant cave-dwelling relatives, and maybe in a certain sense we have. We now have the means to connect to the internet through cellular phones we carry with us everywhere. We can see and talk to someone on the other side of the world through a screen in the comfort of our home. We have devices that entertain us in ways that maybe 10 years ago would have seemed impossible. In some, from the outside we may appear as an advanced species on the verge of the next great discovery. But for all our pseudo-achievements, we have yet to eradicate war, famine, violence, murder, intolerance, and the ever-increasing destruction of our planet. We've yet to fully embrace that realization that unites us all. We've yet to tear down the barriers that alienate us from each other even when we stand a feet apart. We've yet to see the bigger picture. Mr. Rivera's experience and the reality that stems from it and that is laid out in this book implies one of the most, if not the most, significant events in human history. But even more important than all of this, at least for the time being, is the revelation of a current state of affairs which is increasingly shaping up to be our ticket to our own demise, a demise that would only come about as a result of our own actions or lack thereof. The information given to Mr. Amory Rivera still rings true and valuable today as it did more than 20 years ago when it was initially passed on. The reason: our humanity still presses on in a counterproductive direction. Those worlds in space are as countless as all the grains of sand on all the beaches of the Earth. Each of those worlds is as real as ours, and every one of them is a succession of incidents, events, occurrences which influence its future. Countless worlds, numberless moments, an immensity of space and time. And our small planet at this moment. Here we face a critical branch point in history. What we do with our world, right now, will propagate down through the centuries and powerfully affect the destiny of our descendants. It is well within our power to destroy our civilization and perhaps our species as well. If we capitulate to superstition or greed or stupidity, we could plunge our world into a time of darkness deeper than the time between the collapse of classical civilization and the Italian Renaissance. But we are also capable of using our compassion and our intelligence, our technology and our wealth to make an abundant and meaningful life for every inhabitant of this planet. Carl Sagan. The mere fact of Mr. Rivera's encounter and its nature, in itself, strongly and steadfastly challenges those minds who cannot conceive of life elsewhere, intelligent life at that, or that feel threatened by it. These minds are numerous and some have firm grounding in the decision-making process of our world's affairs. Mr. Rivera has suffered greatly on personal, professional, social, physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual levels on account of his coming forth with his experience. Yet thanks to his unbreakable spirit and compassionate soul, the story of his encounter. Let's just say the extension of his contacts with an extraterrestrial reality, are now for the first time available in the English language. This book is another bold attempt to try and stir this Earth's humanity in a more positive and productive way of life, and also to give it a glance into the rewards that a more spiritual orientation of resources and knowledge may entitle us to. Gualberto Del Toro, Los Angeles, California. July 16, 2011. Note from the author. I want to start out by saying that I'm not a writer by profession. This is my first book which tells of my experience in its entirety. My honest wish is that with it I'm able to create awareness about the existence of alien beings and their intentions towards humanity. Amori. Introduction. It is my intention to let it be known that experiences such as the one I had and continue having to this day, really do happen. Also, I know of thousands of people who have gone through the same experience or at the very least similar. People who chose to remain silent for fear of being ridiculed or treated cruelly. We must not criticize or attack those people who chose not to speak, or even say they're egotistic. They surely have good reason to do so. I myself am a victim of mockery and insults as a result of me speaking out, even when I have evidence that backs up my story. I'm not writing to try and convince anyone. Even I didn't believe in beings that came from other parts of the cosmos to visit us. I have to see in order to believe, and there is no other way I would have believed in the existence of extraterrestrial beings. If the day ever comes that I come in contact with fairies, only then will I believe in fairy tales. But if you think about it, who's to say that fairy tales didn't originate from extraterrestrial encounters in the past? This I don't know. What I can assure you, without a doubt, is that presently there exist encounters with extraterrestrial beings. Chapter 1. In March of 1988, I was still living in New York City, where I was born and raised. Back then my life was very different, very fast-paced. It seemed like there wasn't really time to think about the things that really mattered in life. Things like family, our environment, nature, and many other things that I do think about today. I used to work in a hotel in the city and I made good money, but I felt empty. In my life there only existed work and pleasure, with nothing in between. Though I wasn't aware of it, my whole existence was very superficial. Life in New York is usually crude and rough, and most of all aggressive. I found myself living in a contaminated jungle of steel and iron with stench of sewer. But I didn't realize it. It was my home, my birthplace. I got lost in its wilderness. Around that time I received an alarming phone call from my Aunt Marlene, who informed me that my abuela, grandmother, Isabel, the woman who had raised me, was sick and wanted to see me. I got from my aunt that this was an emergency, that it could very well be the last time I would see the person whom I considered my mother alive. I had plenty of vacation and sick days accumulated at work, so I left for Puerto Rico immediately. Not long after I arrived, Mama, my grandmother, got better. I decided to then take my trip and turn it into a real vacation. I visited a lot of beaches in Cabo Rojo, which is a small town in the southwestern part of Puerto Rico that's surrounded with beautiful landscapes and beaches, and it's also where my parents were born. You can still find there simple and humble people that make me proud to be a Puerto Ricano. There are other places like this in Puerto Rico, but I mention Cabo Rojo because it's where my family's from. Although I'd been in the island before, this time was much different. I fell in love with its beaches and I was in awe of its beautiful hills and green valleys. During the day I danced with the sun and at night I courted the moon. One night in particular I got to meet the stars. I was sitting in the balcony of Mama's house when the power went out. When that happened, the sky opened up before my eyes. It was spectacular. For a lot of people this may not be very impressive. The same as the Empire State Building not being very impressive to those who live near this skyscraper in New York. For me it was unforgettable. Because there wasn't any light coming from anywhere, I could observe the starry sky without interference. I know that to many this would seem silly, but for me it was a key event in my life. The night of the stars marks the beginning of my relationship with the cosmos, though at the time I wasn't aware of it. I had had opportunity in the past to look at the sky, but never in such an awe-inspiring manner. Growing up in New York, I never could really observe the sky. The lights of the theaters and billboards always seemed more interesting. The skyscraper's radiance and the public lighting always obscured the sky. 42nd Street and Broadway Avenue replaced the stars. For the first time I had discovered the splendor and glow of thousands of suns. I stopped talking to Mama as I looked in awe. "What are you looking at so intensely?" she asked. "The stars look different. They look bigger, I don't know, closer perhaps," I answered. She then told me that she had seen them before like that. She wasn't impressed. I, on the other hand, was still struck. The power came back and I got sad. You could still see the stars, but not in the same way. The next day I left Puerto Rico and I wept. While back in New York I kept thinking about Puerto Rico. I thought not only of my family, but also about everything else. I felt something calling me back to the island, an inner sort of subliminal voice. Maybe during the night of the stars something changed in me. It was as if the instant I saw that sky a small seed was planted in my brain. This psychological or symbolical seed was the one who sprouted into the obsessive idea of me moving to Puerto Rico. I called my grandmother, Mama, and my aunt and I told them about my plans. My grandmother thought it was a good idea, but my aunt thought I was crazy to leave a good job and an apartment in New York to come to Puerto Rico. She reminded me that jobs were scarce. In spite of that, I still wanted to go. They heard such urgency in my voice that they asked me if I had run into some trouble in New York. I told them that even I didn't quite understand my sudden impulse. Even though I felt like a magnet was pulling me to the island, that night when I went to bed I thought that my aunt was probably right. I decided to stop with all the nonsense and reconsider. There was no future for me in Puerto Rico. Many of my relatives were unemployed, so what better chances had I? Lying in my bed with the unusual sounds of the city, the police sirens, ambulances and the street noise in the city that never sleeps, I slept. That night, however, something woke me. I dreamt I was in Puerto Rico. I was watching the sunset, same as I had in Cabo Rojo, a huge red-orange ball of fire. It was magnificent. Right then and there, in the darkness of my room, I made a decision: Puerto Rico. The next day I started to give away some of my belongings and selling the rest. My friends were surprised. They didn't understand why I was doing all this. The fact that I myself didn't understand the reasons for my actions surprised them even more. The island was calling my name. I felt it my home. I had already told Mama about my plans and she was very happy. In less than 2 weeks I gave up my apartment, I took my pet to the veterinary, went to the bank, and to the travel agency. By mid-1988 I was already back in Puerto Rico, this time accompanied by my dog. Her name was Christina. I was so happy. Like I had just accomplished something. I felt relief, like a great weight had been lift off of my shoulders. At last I arrived, I told myself. As far as work was concerned, I decided to buy a hot dog cart and make a living selling franks and refreshments. A cousin of mine, however, heard on the radio that a nightclub in the town of Hormigas was looking for a waiter. I didn't know where the place was, but I found someone who showed me. I still didn't have a car, and according to my cousins, in Puerto Rico you need a one for everything. I was interviewed at the club Casablanca and the owner was very impressed with my hotel experience. I started work that very weekend. I would work in the club on weekends, and I would find a full-time job during the week. One of my cousins drove me the first few days. He then told me of a friend of his that was selling a 1971 Toyota. The car wasn't in great shape, but it would do until I'd buy a better one. My transportation's issues were settled. Part of the route that leads to Hormigas goes through what is known in Cabo Rojo as La Bajura, an old infrequently traveled road that goes from Cabo Rojo to Hormigueros. That same cousin who used to drive me told me that in that sector one had to be really careful because sometimes animals from neighboring estates would cross that road. He told me that a lot of people had died as a result of hitting a cow or horse on the road. One has not to worry about these things in New York. One only has to watch out for those little yellow animals called taxis. I heeded my cousin's advice then, and I still do today. I bought that white Toyota. By the beginning of May I had already established a routine and I felt at ease with myself. My happiness didn't last long though. It lasted until Mother's Day, which actually turned into the night of the encounter. What I'm about to narrate happened that day. It filled my life with terror and confusion. I will never be the Amori I was back then. All of my perceptions of the world would change. This event yanked away my relatively simple existence and transformed it into a very complicated life, full of uncertainty and even more rejection than what I was used to. In essence, I was born again. Chapter 2. My cousin, who was always listening to her radio, had heard that the salsa orchestra called El Gran Combo was going to be playing at Casablanca. She called me immediately and asked if I could do her a favor. Since she mentioned El Gran Combo, I thought that maybe she wanted me to get her tickets or something for the show. However, she only asked if I could take some pictures with her camera. I didn't have a choice, since she gently reminded me that she had gotten me that job. In truth, I said yes, hoping that she would forget about it, but unfortunately she didn't. That night I arrived at the club with my dear cousin's camera, one of those cheap Kodak 110. To make matters worse, she had given me one of El Gran Combo's records so that every member would sign it. I remember well that night, since the place had never been more packed. All the mothers were elegantly dressed and accompanied by their significant others, and there were floral arrangements everywhere. The tables were decorated with white sheets, candles and small arrangements. The place smelled like flowers and perfume, which gave me allergies. There were only four of us waiting tables, and every customer wanted to be served at the same time. Unfortunately, some of the people there, including the mothers, transformed into monsters after a few drinks. Only a fellow waiter knows what it's like to walk through a room packed with people carrying a tray full of drinks. Panic can instill if, when you get to your table, someone from another one pulls you by the arm carrying the drinks, to tell you, "Waiter, another beer." To sum up, that night was hell. Women who had way much to drink insisted on dancing with me. They didn't want to hear about the rules of my workplace. They still wanted to dance with, even with me having an arm full of drinks. It was difficult to take pictures of the group. I managed to get some while they were playing and others when they were on break. I must confess something that my cousin is not going to like. I left the record behind the bar, but I told her that all of them had signed it, but someone then stole it. The truth is that I didn't have the courage to go up to them and ask that each would sign the record. She got mad because she thought I'd stolen the record, but she was happy when I brought her camera back. By closing time I could barely stand my feet. Also, I looked like I'd just gotten out of a sauna, clothes on and all. I called it a night after emptying the ashtrays and organizing my tables. Afterwards, I went to the bar to get my cigarettes and the camera, but I left the record. I knew that when I came back it was going to be gone. Now that I think about it, I actually didn't lie when I told my cousin her record was stolen. I headed to the parking lot, where the partying continued. There were couples everywhere. It was after 4 a.m. and these people were still at it. At that time the women didn't look so elegant and the men were not behaving like gentlemen. I walked through the crowd to my car like a zombie. I only had one thing in mind, getting home. Finally I got to my car, anxious to leave. Little by little the other cars started to head out. I placed the camera in the glove compartment. I turned the engine on and I took off as usual. I took the main road, road number 2, until I reached the intersection that took me to La Bajura. Once I started heading down this sector I noticed a dense fog on the road, very thick and white. It was nothing out of the ordinary. I had gone through the same area at around the same time, 4:30 in the morning. I was driving very slowly, paying close attention to the road. My thoughts at the time were of possibly encountering an animal on the road and preventing an accident. Also, I thought of the pain in my feet and what I'd fixed myself to eat when I got home. All of a sudden I heard a noise, as if someone or something were running close to my car and was trying to catch up and pull right next to me. Everything happened very fast. I heard the steps and thought it was some kind of animal, when out of the corner of my eye I perceived a movement on my left-hand side. I turned my head and what I saw was not a cow or a lamb. My mind didn't know what to think. A boy with a costume? But, at this hour? A midget? Yes, it was a midget with a mask scaring the people going by. A midget? No, it can't be, I thought to myself. Its head, those eyes, no, even the mouth, nothing was. Go away, I told myself. It was something like a bizarre little man running beside my car. In my panic I intended to hit the gas but I hit the brake instead and the car came to an abrupt stop. I looked through the windshield wanting to keep going far away from that place, far from that strange creature that was running beside my car without taking its strange eyes off of me. I couldn't do this however, because now that being with the enormous head was right in front of my car, on the right side, walking towards me from the fog. The right headlight of my car was now on him, making it look even more grotesque. Its pale skin was reminiscent of clown makeup. It was wearing tight fighting clothes, olive green in color. The clothing didn't shine or had anything distinct features other than who or what was wearing it. Its arms were proportionate with its body, which was about 3.5 feet tall. I thought to myself, how could it ever reach that side of my car so quickly? In response I heard another noise beside my door. There was the creature beside me again but much closer. It was then that I realized that there were actually two creatures, or people, demons, or whatever. I felt them opening the door. I couldn't take it anymore. I found myself paralyzed. I don't know if it was fear, sheer terror or something else, but I simply couldn't move. Again, everything happened very quickly, in a matter of seconds. I couldn't handle it anymore and I fainted. I want the reader to know that at the time never did it cross my mind that there was a possibility these could be extraterrestrial creatures. The subject never really attracted my attention. I thought they might be monsters or demons, but never beings from space. When I came to, I was still in my car, confused, and when I looked around I thought I was in some sort of underground parking. I say this because that place was not outside, there were other cars there, another 10 or so. There were no doors or signs. It was subtly lit and was light gray in color. I noticed the other cars were empty and there was utter silence. I remember listening to my own agitated breathing and peeking out to find a way out, a door, or some sign that would point to an exit. The clearer and alert my mind became, the more desperate I got. I felt I was out of air and my breathing became even more irregular. I started to feel very claustrophobic. I didn't hear any sound nor did I hear it arrive. There, right beside me was that little man with the chilling eyes. I remember making an odd frightened sound but I didn't utter a word. I felt paralyzed. Its eyes were piercing and when I saw him I remembered what had transpired on the road. During those brief seconds I forgot about not knowing where I was and how to get out of there. All of my being was fixed on that creature with the feature's head and almond-shaped cow eyes. He looked at me without any sort of emotion or facial expressions. Seated at the wheel of my car I felt hopeless, like a trapped little animal. I tried everything to deny this fact, but to no avail. All of a sudden it started to raise its right arm until I could see his little hand. I became even more tense. My hands were at the wheel. I'm surprised I didn't yank it off. I couldn't move or take my hands off of it. Truth be told, I probably shouldn't say I really couldn't move because I never tried. I think that my dazed and traumatized mind didn't let me. My mind, my brain was incapable of commanding my body. The creature was reaching for my forehead. I felt repugnance, disgust. Imagine if someone would reach for your face with something you're terrified of, like a snake, a mouse or anything that would cause you panic. Its hand for me was all those things wrapped up in one. This strange being, whom I still considered something diabolical, placed the palm of its hand on my forehead, and with a last spasm of repugnance my mind went blank. When I woke up I found myself seated with other people in a squared room. My neck and hands were hurting, I felt my eyes swollen. Where was I? Where was my car? I couldn't really distinguish where the room's walls began or ended. It gave the impression of being a big infinite space instead of room. The floor, walls and ceiling were all light gray in color, and like the other place I didn't see any lamps, light bulbs, entrances, exits, or windows, but I figured that logically, although none of this seemed logical, there had to be doors and lights even though I couldn't see them. Where did the light come from? I didn't know. If a person were to stand in the middle of this room, alone, with no point of reference, you would think he'd be standing in a great void. With me the 14 other people. Men and women, and from the looks of it Hispanic. We were seated in some sort of chairs or long benches. You couldn't really see these seats at a single glance. Only because I was seated on one of them I could tell they were there. How I got there was a mystery to me. The floor, walls, and ceiling were of the same color tone which gave the appearance of total continuity, like a camouflage or optical illusion. I was still a little dazed when I noticed that the creatures were right in front of us. I saw them over the shoulders of the people in front of me. No one said a word and you could sense the terror in the air. I could barely move, I was only able to turn my head and with great difficulty. I felt a cramp in my neck. I was seated in the left-hand side of the last row. Each row had five people and there were three rows in total. To my right there was a teenager. He was wearing shorts, was barefoot and didn't have a shirt on. He looked a lot like my brother when he was a teenager. When I saw the fear in his face I wanted to try and ease it but I couldn't. The others were dressed in different ways, from party clothes to sleepwear. Meanwhile, there stood those two with the extraordinary heads completely still. Every once in a while they would blink very slowly. All of our attention was directed towards them. Coming from an undetermined place behind us, there approached another being who wore black clothing. He walked towards the creatures and stood between them. His skin color was that of someone who has a tan, it had a copper-like tone. His hair was black and straight and he wore it a little over shoulder length. It was combed back. He was very handsome. His shirt, which didn't seem to have buttons or pockets, had long, slightly loose sleeves. His pants were slim-fitting at the waist yet slightly loose in the legs and a little tapered at the bottom. His shirt was tucked in and he wore black boots. He was approximately 5'7" or 5'8". His body was slim but toned. After taking position, he addressed us in perfect Spanish with no accent in particular. Welcome, my name is Amaran. I'm not here to hurt you. Relax, don't be frightened. I come from a planet that goes by the name of Ka, which is pronounced like your letter of the alphabet K, and as it is my home planet. I am as human as you are. These were more or less his words. I want to stress that these were not his exact words.